Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me. It's my first time here. First I'll share a dirty secret with you, and that's that I'm not a real biologist, like the real biologists say, but I'm a computational biologist. So I thought it would be fun, since usually I talk with just the average biologist, to add some a little bit mathematical justification in some parts. So I arranged my talk in two sections. The first section is going to be about HiSeq, this new technology. I'll talk about what we can measure with it and some of the methods. I'll try to give you some additional details so you can be a little more critical about what we do and what we see. In the second part, I'm going to tell you of how a specific model that we're trying to understand a specific pattern that we see. Okay, so let's start. So the human genome is 3 billion base pairs long, and we have two copies of that since we're diploid. And given the length of how much a base pair is in the double helix, we get about 2 meters. And we want to fit this in the nucleus, which is about 10 microns. Actually, it's not a big deal in terms of just fitting it in terms of the volume, because if you consider, for example, the sperm nucleus, it's about 20-fold smaller in its volume. So it can be much more compact if you want. But instead, the importance is not just that this is a random molecule. This is perhaps one of the most important molecules that we have, because it holds the genetic information. Everything we activate in the cell is based on this, so we need to be able to access it and to regulate it properly. Okay, so what's known about how this is organized? So apart from the double helix, the basic level of organization is what was mentioned here, is these nucleosomes. So you have 147 base pairs of DNA wrapped around a histone octamer. Histones are conserved proteins. And this is the basic level, and this is relatively well understood. But as we go beyond that, much less is known. We don't really have very good methods to study this. When you get to the larger scales, then actually most of the time the chromosomes don't look like this. They're, most of the time they look more like this. And this doesn't mean that there isn't structure, that it's just much more complicated. Okay.
So the banded version is a case where a cell is about to divide? Is that
yes. I'll talk about this a little later, but this is only when cells are about to divide, and they have this condensed form. So why is this interesting? So it turns out, again, this is not just some molecule. This is a molecule that has very important information, and chromatin structure is very tightly linked with function. So at the basic level of nucleosomes and so on, this is very well understood, where some regions that are packed are not accessible. But at higher scales, the main thing that interests people, I would say, is gene regulation. This is a very good example. So the idea is that we have genes. This is the mammalian dogma of how genes are activated. You have a promoter, which is a sequence just upstream of the gene, which is a control sequence. So this encodes for the protein. This is a control sequence. And it gets activated through interaction with what's called an enhancer, which is a control sequence, which can be very, very far away. It can be even a megabase away. Okay, so, but very, very large distances. And usually this is the thought of how it works, that there's some kind of interaction and then the gene gets activated. And gene regulation is one of the central processes for cells to decide on what they do and give the cell their identity, okay? So neurons and blood cells have the same DNA. One of the differences is the set of genes that they activate. Okay.
So in reality, there are many histones between E and P that you're just not showing them here? Or?
Yes, so this is a megabase, so this is a million base pairs. The histones, the nucleosomes, are 147. So that's tiny in terms of the scale, okay? The scale here, just to give you another example, a million base pairs is about the size of a yeast chromosome. Okay, so very, very long distances. Okay. So, chromatin has been studied for a very long time. The nucleus early studies are from, I would say, 150 years ago. Then this is not the earliest. And it's been observed that there are drastic changes in the nucleus. And since then, we've gotten much better in terms of the microscopy. Here you can see the individual chromosomes. This is in their packed form. This is not in what's called interphase when they're spread out. But still, we haven't gotten as far as we want in terms of resolution. We really can't see all the interesting structures. So at the same time, in parallel to this, there was, with the advancements in molecular biology, we had the start of the genomics era. So genomes started to get sequenced, and these serve as a map that you can now map all kind of biological features to sequences and then position them relative to each other. So this was a big advance, and in the last decade, we also had a huge technological advance in DNA sequencing technology, what's called next generation sequencing. So now we can very easily measure millions of reads of DNA and use those as markers of positions on the genome. So what we end up with is thousands of these genomic tracks where we can map various features to the genome and then compare these tracks. So in this place, in this example, we see the positions of nucleosomes that were mapped, and this consists of many, many, many reads on top of each other. Okay, and we can compare them with the positions of genes and try to figure out what biology is going on here.
What is a read?
A read is a sequencing read. So you read one. So the way this works is you give it a sample of DNA, which has a lot of different molecules of DNA, and every time you read one of these molecules, that's called a read.
So it would be a fragment, or it would be like somebody's saliva?
No, it would be a fragment of DNA. It's a sequence of DNA that you sampled from the sample of DNA. So you have a sample that contains a very large amount of sequences of DNA, and you try to read what that sample contains.
And they're typically chopped up, and then you get lots of...
These are typically very small.
And then there's some sort of assembly of the whole genome from many...
Right, so you map... The thing is that you have the genome sequence, so now you can map them to their position in the genome, and then you can... So, for example, if you can do some experiment where the DNA sample that you end up with marks the position of nucleosomes. So you get a DNA fragment where you saw a nucleosome. Now, if you map it to the genome, you're going to get maps like this, right? So each one of these, this is a stack of many reads in this position indicating there was a nucleosome in this position.
Oh, okay. So I have all these reads, all these DNA fragments, and I put it in that box in the middle. Okay. What does the box do?
This reads before? This reads, but it can read 100 million in one experiment. Very
okay, true. So it just... It puts out a gigabyte of data very fast. It tells the sequence of each one of the fragments that it found.
Yes.
And then on the right, you have, you said there was a nucleosome there. That's one of those little spindle things.
Mm-hmm. So you can map all kinds of different biological features, chemical modification on the genome, the positions of genes. So essentially what happened is that people started to convert molecular biology experiments and biochemical experiments, so their outputs can be read in terms of DNA sequences. So they can map various features to the genome sequence and get these kinds of maps.
So for a given sequence of A, T, Gs, and Cs, then we know that there's likely to be a histone attached to it? Is that what histone locations are determined?
So
the blue thing, mm-hmm. we can't... I see there's a bunch of little peaks and there's a blue thing, and you say it comes from many reads.
Yes. But so the height is would be the number of reads.
What does it mean if there's a number of the number of reads is not the same in every position, because sometimes the blue is higher and sometimes it's lower.
Right, that's right.
Does that mean a high one is that 50,000 reads that had that?
Yes. This is the amount of times you saw something at this position. You saw a read.
That something is not just a base.
And yeah, so you the DNA that you start with is a result of an experiment that measured whatever you wanted.
Yes.
On the DNA. But I don't want to get too much into this detail because this is just an example of. So I don't want to talk specifically about this.
Okay, I understand, but I'm supposed to get something out of those little blue mountains. Maybe I'm supposed to get that it's a regular sawtooth.
So each one of these peaks, its width is 147 base pairs.
Ah.
And this means that you saw a nucleosome at this position, or you saw the read that mapped to this position this many times.
This is the height.
Let's say advance a little, and then we'll see.
Okay.
We should definitely do that. The difference between red and blue?
It doesn't matter in this case. It could be a different type of data or in a different type of condition. So now to the specific technology I want to talk about. So this is called chromosome conformation capture, or for short, 3C. This was developed by Job Decker in his postdoc and later in his lab. And this really transformed the way we study genome structure. And the idea of this experiment, so I'll tell you the details in a minute, but the general idea is to measure loci in the places in the DNA that were in physical proximity to each other, capture that, and measure the output with DNA. Okay, with DNA sequence. So we take a population of cells, we cross-link them with formaldehyde. So this means now that loci that were close together get physically attached. Now we cut it with an enzyme that cuts at specific sequences. This specific one is called HindI3, and we get these kinds of molecules. Now we ligate them, so they're attached with an enzymatic reaction. So we get these kinds of molecules. And then we isolate it, and we end up with a collection of molecules where one side came from one place in the genome, the other from another place in the genome. And this indicates that they were in close proximity to each other. Okay, so we end up with what we call a library, which is going to have millions and millions of these pieces. And now we can interrogate these in different ways and try to learn about what interacted with each other and learn about the structure.
And the size of those things could vary all over the map, right?
The size of these molecules?
Yeah, each one of those things and books in the library could be tiny, it could be huge, right?
You mean the size of
one
the molecule
of those molecules?
It will generally be linked to how frequently this enzyme cuts.
In general, because you have so many restriction sites.
Right. I'll talk about this in a minute, about the number of restriction sites and so on.
Okay. And that loop is somehow broken open. You remove the formaldehyde and then you break it?
Yeah, you break it. It doesn't actually have to be a loop. It can also be ligated just on one side. I won't get into too many technical details here. So now you can read it in many different ways. In the first version of this in 2002, you could just probe for specific sequences. So you could look for two specific sequences in the genome, how frequently they interact. And with the development of high-throughput sequencing technology, you could do other things. So you could do one specific position versus all the genome. You could look at many versus many. These have different names. This is called 4C, this is called 5C. And today I'll talk mainly about the version which measures all the positions of the genome versus all of them, usually called HiC. Okay? So essentially what you do is you try to just sequence as many as possible from this library. HiC has a few additional experimental tricks, but I won't talk about that. But this is the main idea. Okay? So how frequently you see a specific read interacting tells you how sorry, the number of reads that you see from two given positions tell you how frequently they interact. Okay. So if you see a molecule many times that and they map to two distinct regions, if you see those two regions appearing many times, it means they interact frequently.
Well, it's the frequency of their proximity. It doesn't necessarily mean they interact in the...
I mean interaction in the physical sense.
Yeah, they just physically could be located together.
That's what I'm going to call an interaction.
How can you map forward, backward the position where the two DNA are interacting from this?
So, because I know the sequence of the genome, then I know what this sequence, where the position in 1D was, and what the position of this was. Okay? And the fact that they are together means that they went through this process, so they must have been close together. Yeah.
The cross-linking is only for, is of equal probability, or depending on where it is?
Yes, it should be equal probability, but I'll talk a little bit about how we can correct for something.
Yeah. We're dragging you down with details, but this is the main point of having you here, okay? Yes. So, are you saying that those little red snippets that are in the library are each long enough so that there's only going to be one with a sequence like that in the entire DNA that you're trying to map?
Oh, so, yeah, so it has to map, you're right, it has to map, it has to be long enough so we can map it uniquely.
To
the right
position
place.
On the whole DNA which has been sequenced.
Yes, that's a good point, and that's not always the case. So some regions in the genome are very repetitive, and then it's a problem to map.
And the HIND3 sequence, the cutting sequence, was chosen so that it's relatively far apart so you can actually make it work.
Yeah, I'll talk about this now.
Okay, but you were telling us about one versus one, and that, I didn't get that.
So essentially, you can ask, if you have this now library of molecules in the tube, now you can try to read this in different ways. So you can take all of it and put it into this machine, which just samples from it. Or you can ask for a specific, two specific loci in the genome, whether how frequently they interact. With a different experiment called PCR, but I don't want to get into it.
Okay, that's all right. With PCR, that's all right. But you say, I want to know where I'm going to see GGA, GDA, TT, whatever. And I'm going to look through everything in the library and just look up that one search string.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, I could do that. All right. And so now they can do all possible pairs. Yeah. All right.
Okay. Great. So this is the basic experiment, and the output usually looks like this. So usually you get a map, you can plot it for the whole genome. Here I'm showing just for three chromosomes. So you can plot a matrix where you put these three chromosomes basically against themselves. And now for each entry, you get how frequently these two loci interact. Okay, so you look at the intersection, for example, between this position and this position, and if you want to see how frequently they interact, you look at the color here. Okay? And now...
For one particular cell type, or if you say frequencies, or what's your...
Yes, you take one cell type, one population of cells, you do this experiment, and when you cross-link, you essentially give, you get like a single point in time.
And this was originally done for yeast, and but you were seeing the result for human cells here? Or?
No, it wasn't. Actually, the first time this was done, 3C was initially done in yeast. High C for the first time was done in human. Okay. So by now, this has been done in a lot of different species. I'm going to be focusing mostly on mammals.
Okay, so I noticed the scale, 100 megabytes. And megabases.
Computational biologists make this mistake. This is their abbreviation.
But enough length to recognize is like less than 100 bases, right?
Yes.
100 bases, you've got it nailed, right?
Yes.
Pretty much. And so the scale is way finer than you showed it there.
Yeah, so
I could blow this up to be 3 times the screen and you would still
I'm not involved. Yeah, I did not see it.
Okay. So the point is that there is, as you mentioned, there's a lot going on here. So you can zoom in. Now this is 10 megabase, 1 megabase, and you can zoom in even further. I'll show this later. And you see that there's a lot of interesting patterns going on. So you could expect maybe to see nothing, especially since this is over a population of cells, maybe things are not consistent. But there's a lot of structure.
And these patterns are reproducible between two experiments.
Yes, they're extremely reproducible.
And you mentioned this a moment ago, but again, what cell type was this done on?
This is in human fibroblasts, the specific one, but this was done in many different cell types.
And the patterns vary from type to type?
The types, I'm going to talk about this, but the types in general, of the types of patterns you have are generally conserved, but some of them can change.
So the diagonal is just the sequence with itself.
So yeah, so the distance increases this way, so you see that at near distances there are more interactions. I'll also discuss this.
The actual diagonal.
The actual diagonal is it can be caused from the sequence. There are some artifacts that you can get from it's circling with itself, or it doesn't get digested, or all kinds of technical things. We can usually ignore just the diagonal.
Can you remove it?
Yes, we usually remove it actually.
And this map is kind of implying that different chromosomes don't interact with each other.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about all this right now.
But again, the word interact is loaded because I mean, I can imagine, you know, interacting as in, you know, affecting gene expression versus just being co-located in space. And one does not follow from the other.
Right.
So you're going to
disentangle. I'm talking only about physical interaction.
But the word interaction,
there are genetic interactions. There are a lot of different kinds of interactions.
How many cells go into making this plot?
I'll mention it in a minute. It's usually between 1 million and 100 million.
Does the cell type you pick from matter as to what results you get up from these?
It does. For some of the patterns, yes, and some of the patterns, no. Again, I'll show you this. Yeah.
And you'll tell us
what's on your next slide.
Okay. So some numbers. So this will answer some of your questions. Okay. So let's talk a little more practically about numbers. So we said 3 billion base pairs. That's the human genome size. The restriction enzyme site is 6 base pairs long, usually. There are versions where you do it with 4 base pairs. I'll talk about this if I have time. So the restriction fragment length, if you calculate, it's going to be about 4 kb. And this sets the optimal resolution of the experiment. Okay, so this is the basic sizes that you get. Now, let's think about the number of restriction fragments you have given the genome size. So you're going to have 750,000 restriction fragments. So what's the interaction space like? So this is the size of the interaction space. It's very large. Okay, this is the point. Now, this could be a problem. So even though we have this amazing sequencing technology, which is advancing faster than Moore's law, when you do one sequencing experiment, what's called a lane, you get about 100 million usable reads. This costs about $2,500. Okay. Now you see that this is much smaller than this. Okay. So this already suggests there's going to be a problem. In addition, to answer another question here, the number of cells per experiment is between 1 million and 100 million. And there are about 10,000 to 100,000 interactions you can measure per cell. We're not really sure about this number, but potentially this can be another problem, right? Because if you don't have enough interactions in your experiment, you might not be able to measure the very infrequent interactions. Okay, so what this means in general is we have to realize that interaction space is going to be undersampled. But, and this is an important issue, luckily for us, the interaction map is highly non-uniform. So some regions, as you saw, tend to interact much more frequently, so you're going to get a reasonable sampling there. Other regions, the sampling is going to be very, very poor. Okay, so we have to realize that there's an inherent problem in this experiment that limits the resolution and some of the capabilities. Okay, so practically, the solutions are, one is to reduce the interaction space. So what you can do is you can bin and essentially lower the resolution, or you can do focused experiments that measure only a subset of the map. I won't talk about this that much. Another thing is just to sequence more. This costs a lot of money. This won't solve all the problems, but it helps a little bit. And third, we just need to acknowledge the limitations of the technology. Practically, what this means...
Sorry. Tell us roughly how the price has dropped. So this 2.5 kilobucks 10 years ago would have been 25,000 kilobucks?
It's dropped over time.
It's sequencing. I think sequencing with the human genome. What was the amount? Like
billions.
Many billions. Like something like $100 billion, something like that. Today, with one lane of sequencing, you can get coverage of the genome of the human genome of. You can easily sequence the human genome. So. So you can see how huge reduction is. Okay, so practically what this means that the effective resolution we're going to get is usually, so it kind of depends on the pattern you're looking at, but it's something in this range. If you sequence a lot, maybe 5 kb, this is just in the last year that people have gotten this, usually it's around 50 kb. And luckily for us, it seems that library complexity, which is this issue, is not a big limitation yet. Okay, so just to show you in terms of resolution, so this is at what's called the optimal resolution. This is at 4 kb. It looks very, very noisy. And this is at 40 kb. You can see much better what's going on. Okay, so a tiny bit about, I was asked about this, about how we normalize the data. So some problem with these sequencing technologies is that you have locus-specific biases. Some places are difficult to map to. Some sequences get sequenced much more. So we use the following assumption that the sum of reads from every row and column should be approximately equal. And this is based on the fact that you start with DNA in your tube and you really didn't get rid of any DNA in the experiment. So we start with a number of genome copies, so we assume it should be approximately equal. And it turns out that there's a good way of doing this. So this is based on a theorem by Sinkhorn. Given a symmetric matrix A with positive elements, which is basically what we have, we can find a unique doubly stochastic matrix, which means the rows and the columns sum to 1, and a diagonal matrix D with strictly positive elements such that this happens. So practically what this means is the following, that if this is the read count between I and J, we can find bias factors for each bin, a bias factor. So this is going to be just a vector of bias factors, and this will be the normalized read count. Okay? And this is a very simple, there's a very simple algorithm to calculate. So this is how we normalize, and you can see that it works quite well. So you see things like this, that just now everything looks much more smooth.
And you're going to tell us what these horizontal and vertical white lines mean?
The gray one is missing data, things we filter out.
Is there some biology associated with that, or is this?
These are usually repetitive regions that you can't map enough.
I see.
Okay.
Can you repeat again this previous line, like about the bias, the one from
definitions?
Yeah, definition.
This one?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't really get why it eventually smooths the data if you look at the DAG.
Yeah, so it doesn't have to smooth the data. the fact that it does smooth the data, I think, tells us that it does something right, because, well, it depends a little bit on what your biological assumptions are, but we don't expect there to be huge changes that looked like this, essentially, in terms of the biology. But you're right that you need to make some... I mean, the fact that it smooths the data is not...
What did you point to when you showed it? We don't want it to look like this.
So when you see something like this, this is...
those crosses.
This is one position which seems not to interact with almost anything else.
Including itself. How big are the teeth?
Including itself. That's another indication that it's probably wrong. Okay. But it turns out if you multiply it by some number, it becomes...
So they need to get rid of this.
So you can see it gets rid of all these.
They were just undersampled. Those white places were just undersampled for some reason. Is that what you're compensating for? Mm-hmm. Is in that direction?
All kinds of, yeah, there are a number of biases that can have this causes. Yeah.
But how different from one of the D's?
Sorry?
What is the range of the D's?
What is the range of... Sorry?
You had these weighting factors D. Does it go from 1 to a million or 1 to a 10 or
something? That's a good question. I think it's... No, it definitely doesn't go into a thousand. It goes... It's a good question. But maybe...
You can sort of see it in a color map.
Maybe up to 5 or something. But yeah. Yeah, assuming that you, I don't really want to go too much into the details here again, but the original sum is much more than one. Here you're causing it to be one. So if you forget about that, it's about 5. Yeah.
Can you actually introduce additional white lines?
It does. It's not perfect. It can sometimes cause this thing.
So that's actually creating a gap where there wasn't.
It's not perfect. None of these things are perfect. So it could be that here. So usually we try to catch. There are some. This is probably some region which was problematic, and we should have filtered it out, and we didn't catch it. Okay. So now, in terms of Heisey interpretation, just this is one thing to keep in mind. This famous story about the blind man trying to figure out what this elephant is, and this feels the tail, so he thinks it's a rope, and so on. This one feels that maybe it's a wall, and so on. So essentially, in Heisey, we're a little bit in this situation, because we don't really measure the genome structure. Okay, and you have to keep in mind that we have a large variation of structure. Okay. Plus, there are other inherent problems. You don't see dynamics. You don't see, for example, the genome is diploid. You have two copies, and you can't tell them apart when you're mapping DNA sequences. Okay. So essentially, we have even like a distribution of elephants, right? And we're trying to...
And the actual histone positions are way below your resolution,
yes.
So just ignore them.
We're not really ignoring them, but it's not something you will see in these maps.
But if I had something tightly wound around a histone, would that get in the way of the formaldehyde, for example?
No, actually, you need the histone, because it has to be protein mediated in order to get across them.
So that gives you the proteins you need.
Yeah.
To do it. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of the approaches to analyze Hi-C, you can go. There's a range. Usually you can separate it into informatic approaches and physical approaches. Physicals are more structure-based, that imply a specific mechanism. So you try to figure out what the underlying structure is. You make some physical assumptions. These are usually predictive and rigorous. They typically tend to be less useful for genomic analysis, and more useful for mechanism. The informatic approaches are usually based on just the patterns. They don't try to understand what the structure is. So they don't give a mechanism. They usually make less assumptions. Usually they're kind of heuristics that don't really give predictions. They're not real models even. But they're useful for genomic analysis. I'll show you this in a minute. So I'm going to mostly show you, actually I'll show you both. But so some example of the structure structural approaches. One is kind of model driven, where you basically come up with a toy model, and you assume some physics, and you try to see if you can reproduce what you see in the high cement. So can you reproduce this kind of interaction probability, you know, with supercoiling and without supercoiling, for example. The other kind of approaches within these structural approaches are data-driven, where you kind of try to get, for example, you could try to come up with a distance matrix and from this calculate what the structure was. Usually there are a lot of assumptions involved in this. Here, for example, there's a big assumption that there's only one structure, which is probably completely incorrect. But you have to assume, you know, how the distances relate to interaction, all kinds of, you know, if it's the, if it's a dynamic model, then how these things move. So there's a lot of assumptions usually involved.
Wouldn't that be massively underdetermined?
Yes, usually yes. Okay, so now specifically I want to talk about the patterns that we see. So the first pattern you see is what some people have mentioned, that as you move away in distance, on average, you see less interaction. Okay, and of course you see there are other patterns here. And so now we're making kind of a simplification that essentially we're ignoring everything else that's happening. So you can plot, this is typical stuff, you guys probably know more about this than me, but typical stuff you do in polymer physics, you, if you plot the average interaction probability with the distance on a log-log scale, if it's a power law decay, you're supposed to get a straight line. And you can try to interpret the slope of the line and see what it means in terms of the structure. I'm probably sure as not to talk about this, so I won't talk about it too much. But in this case, for a high C in humans, this is from the original paper, this is consistent with a structure called a fractal globule, and I'm sure I will talk about this.
This is many disconnected chromosomes are forming this ball on the right, or is it a single connected?
Okay. So no. So these are many. These are many different chromosomes, and one of the predictions of this model, one of the things that it explains is that chromosomes are separated from each other in their own territories. Okay, but I don't want to get into Shura's chromosomal territory. So I will let him talk about this.
The colors in the top unfolded polymer are different meaning than the colors of the chromosomes.
Yes, that's a good point.
Distance along the polymer is denoted in color.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the color of the chromosomes.
That's a good point.
Actually, in the bottom, it's still one.
It's still one?
It's still one.
So it's still one. But in the nucleus, it's going to be different. I'll show you this in a moment.
So the different colors.
So it's this one folded once this way. This is the what's called the equilibrium globule, and this is the fractal. Again, you're probably going to hear about this. Okay, so now this relates to the next thing that we see is chromosome territory. Another thing that people have mentioned, that chromosomes tend to interact with themselves much more than when they interact with other chromosomes. Okay, and this, you can see this clearly over here. This is the map for the whole genome.
And you arrange the chromosomes in descending size as you go down.
They're actually, they're sorted by their number, and their number was given according to the size.
Back in the ancient times, okay.
Yes. Okay, and this is probably what is already been known. This is mainly work from the Kremer lab, that they show that even in interphase, in the stage where the chromosomes are not condensed, each chromosome occupies its own space, its own volume. So they're not mixed. Okay. So this is probably the same.
And nuclei are typically elliptical, as suggested by this picture?
They can be elliptical. There is some signal in this, because now if you think about this, If the chromosome positions would have been conserved, you would have seen some patterns here, right? The fact that you don't really see that much going on here suggests that there's some variation here, right? Because you're looking at a population of cells. However, if you now sum these per chromosome, you do see there's a little bit signal that the smaller chromosomes that are gene-rich tend to interact with each other, and this is consistent with what's been shown in microscopy, that the small chromosomes tend to be in the middle of the nucleus. Okay, so
now gene-rich. Is there a correlation between size and...
Yes, there is a correlation. So the small ones tend to be gene-rich, yes.
So there are
some exceptions.
So most of the so-called junk DNA is on the larger chromosomes.
This is not really junk DNA, but the more the, I would say the inactive chromosome, the inactive chromatin tends to be on the larger chromosomes. Okay, so here I just want to mention single-cell HiC, which is a recent development, which is a new technology developed in Peter Frazier's lab, which essentially allows you to get HiC maps in single cells. This can be very informative. Essentially, they use the fact that when you do this, when you do HiC, you can really keep the nucleus intact, so that you can, most of the HiC can be done inside the nucleus. And then you just take the individual nuclei and separate them into individual tubes and create HiC maps. So this is from a couple of years ago, and this is how a map looks for a single cell. And two caveats you have to keep in mind. First of all, this is still diploid. So you have two copies of the genome that you can distinguish. So it's an average of two conformations here. Second of all, you only have 10,000 to 30,000 interactions per cell. So it's very, very limited in terms of what you can tell in terms of resolution. And so just to show you one thing that you can see, this is one chromosome. This is chromosome 2 plotted versus the other chromosomes in several different cells. Okay? So one thing that you can clearly see is that the interaction interface with other chromosomes is highly variable.
And the diagonal's now been flipped because of the way you've ordered things?
That's, yeah, they just, some people show this one. Okay. So this is the type of things that you can learn from this data, and it's, I think, very promising. Yeah.
Are these cells all relatively in the same phase then?
I think that's a good question. They should be, but yeah, they're definitely not now in condensed form or something.
Like that.
Yeah, I'll talk about that.
And why does chromosome 2 jump out at us?
Because it's this. I'm picking only chromosome 2, so the interaction of chromosome 2 with chromosome 2 is the strongest. That's what we said. The interaction of chromosome itself. It's essentially like you picked one column from here.
And if there were a Y chromosome in the game, would things change?
Because there's only one copy. So they actually did. So they did some analysis on the X chromosome. It was male here, so they had only one copy.
Yes.
So that you can model its structure and so on. Still, the resolution is kind of low to get useful insights, I think. But it's important to say that they're developing this, and this is not published yet. But they talked about having these maps, now they can get about tenfold more interactions per cell, and they have this on a haploid cell line, so there's just one copy of the genome. So this is going to be, I think, very useful data in the future. Of course, you have to keep in mind there's a limit to what you can measure from a single cell, just experimental limit. So you still can't achieve the resolutions you can get in population, I see. Okay. The next signal I want to talk about is what's called genomic compartments. So you see that there's kind of a checkerboard pattern here. Okay, this is a little zoomed in. You have this kind of checkerboard pattern. The way this has been interpreted is as though you can separate the genome into two parts. One is called the A compartment, the other the B compartment, and each part can interact only with itself, or tends to interact more with itself. Okay, and then you get this kind of checkerboard pattern. So A interacts with A, B interacts with B, but A doesn't interact with B. Okay. So the way to find these, I don't know actually if I want to get into the details here, but what you can do is you can do what people tend to do is something like a PCA or SVD. So you do this kind of eigen decomposition, and the reasoning behind it is that if you take the first eigenvector, then this thing is going to be the best Lorak approximation to the original matrix. Okay. So in other words, simply, just to put it simply, if so now you represent this signal of whether you're in A or in B as one vector, V. And if VI and VJ have the same sign, their product will be positive, indicating high interaction. And if they're opposite sign, they're going to be negative. Okay? So that essentially captures this. And this is, you can see this is the vector that we calculate. So this is negative, positive, negative, positive. So you can see, and this is the approximation matrix. So you can see, for example, if you take this blue, then when it interacts with red, it's low. When it interacts with blue, it's high, and so on. So this is just a way of essentially converting this pattern to a one-dimensional chart.
You're just going to take a one-rank representation of this whole thing?
Yeah. This is a way of, yeah, exactly, of capturing this pattern.
Single eigenvalue, a single eigenvector.
Yeah.
And you took the best one you could take.
Yes.
And don't you have to show the real thing and then the right approximation?
So, yeah, so this is the approximation. There's another small detail here that usually, to get this to work better, you usually try to first normalize out the decay. Sometimes you take the correlation matrix, but the idea here, it's not an explicit model of the pattern. Okay, so it's in the end it's some kind of heuristic that's used. I'm just explaining why it might make some sense to use it.
And you do this after you factored out these D's, your biases?
Yes.
Okay. And so the way we're supposed to think of the one on the right is not that it's a confirmation that the decomposition was good, but assuming that there are these checkerboard patterns, this shows the checkerboard.
Right.
That's what it's supposed to do.
Yes.
For the person who wanted to know what interacted with what and what didn't.
Yes.
This is the
right.
This is the.
Interpretation. Right. Again, this is a heuristic and it's not perfect. As, for example, it will only succeed if this pattern is strong enough. If this is not, if there's a different pattern that's stronger, this won't be the first eigenvector.
And as for some principal component analysis eigenvalue?
This is the eigenvalue and these are the vectors. Okay, so why is it useful to have these 1D tracks? Because then you can do stuff like this. So you can take the eigenvector, which now kind of represents this matrix, and now you can compare it to all kinds of tracks that we saw before that are essentially high-throughput experiments of different biological features. Okay, so this one shows shows accessibility of chromatin. These are marks of active chromatin, where genes are active. And this is just general genes, where you can see gene density. Okay. And what you see is that, in general, one type of compartment, which we call the A compartment, tends to be associated with active chromatin that's open and gene dense. Okay. And because of the gene density, you might think that it's not variable between cell types, but actually it is. So, for example, if you look here at two different cell types, this is one cell type and this is the other cell type, when you have a change in the compartment between these two, the accessibility changes also. Okay. So, in general, these do change between cell types, but it's always this type of pattern. Okay, so the compartments can be cell type specific.
When you decompose with one eigenvector like you were, mm-hmm. then you can ask how good was the decomposition, how faithful was that decomposition? Right. And you must have, was there something that we saw that says it's faithful?
No, you didn't see anything. You didn't see any statistic, but I should say about these statistics, it's a problem to evaluate in that way because you have a lot of different patterns in a lot of different strains.
But you could calculate the eigenvalues, right?
Sorry?
You could calculate the eigenvalues. Mm-hmm. Presumably you're picking out the largest eigenvalue.
Yeah.
So what are the other ones?
So it's, yeah, I can say it captures, it depends on the experiment. I think if you normalize out the distance decay, and you take the Pearson correlation matrix, I think it explains about 50% of the variance. It's useful to see that you did something, you know, that's related, you know, that's, you did, it doesn't have anything to do with it, but in the end, in terms of whether it captured the biological phenomena or not, it's difficult to tell from this number.
Could we possibly get our hands on one of these matrices?
Sure.
How much data are we talking about?
How many, you mean reads, or how many? So it
depends. You give us a matrix that you would work with. Are we talking about a megabyte to ship this matrix to us, a gigabyte?
It depends on the resolution and
the
many
thing,
other factors, but I think 100 megabits probably.
Okay.
It depends a lot about different factors. 100 megabytes, sorry.
That's okay. Then we could find the other eigenvectors ourselves.
Good luck.
How much you explained. It's, I'm not saying it is very important, but you have other patterns here that are on top of this. Right?
Okay.
So it sounds to me that the main reason you're doing this one-dimensional thing mm-hmm. is that the stuff you're comparing with is equally one-dimensional.
Sorry, again?
You're comparing your one-dimensional reduction mm-hmm. or all this data to a lot of other one-dimensional mm-hmm. signals.
Right.
But you could also, you know, see if you learn more by assuming you're two eigenvectors.
Sure.
Comparing that.
Sure.
But since your comparison mm-hmm. is with one-dimensional data, anyway.
Sure. I agree. The question to me is, in the end, whether we learn more about the biology from this.
Right. And what there is to be learned is represented by those blue things on the top. So what he's saying, I understand now, this is all you can compare with it, right. So you might as well do a one-dimensional thing. Because that's all you
can
do.
Because in the end, for example, in the end, these compartments, you know, it remains something, you know, abstract that we don't really know what it means in terms of structure. You know, we know that inactive things tend to be on the outside of the nucleus, and active things tend to be on the inside. But again, we don't know, you know, if these really interact. These probably don't happen, all interact together in the same cell, all the A compartments and all the B compartments. Okay, but we don't know what this means in terms of structure.
And H3, K27, and K36 are ways of assessing what goes along chromosome 14, or is it the cell type, or what is it?
Yeah, so these are marks that the cell marks makes a chemical modification to the histones.
Okay.
To know that it should be active.
Oh, I see.
These are marks, chemical marks made by the cell.
You mentioned a distance normalization in order to do this. Obviously, that becomes problematic as you get far from the diagonal, just because of statistics. Do you have to do some sort of regularization and then effectively, do this sort of block diagonal?
You can do, different bin sizes. There are different ways of accommodating. In practice, it's not much of a problem. You can even, for this, because these are consistent, and in fact, these are consistent even, these are genome-wide patterns. So these are even between chromosomes. So you didn't see it in the original maps, but you can see these persisting between chromosomes. So, in general, it's not a problem. Since it's consistent, you can even throw away long distance a lot of different tricks to find this. Okay. I see we're out of time.
Almost.
Okay. So what I'll do is I'll go quickly through a few other things that we see.
And we did ask questions, so
that's fine. And okay, so one kind of recently discovered structure is called topological domains or topologically associating domains. And now I'm going to show the data. I'm going to rotate the matrix. I'm going to rotate the matrix, and since it's symmetric, I'm just going to show you half of it, and sometimes just a part of it. Okay, so now, for example, I'm showing you this, so let's go a little back. Okay, so now these are the positions, and now this is the distance. Okay, so these are, in the original matrix, this would be like squares along the diagonal. Okay. And as the sequencing power became better, we were able to see more high-resolution things. So these are approximately a megabase or half a megabase in size, and they're called TADs. And what these mean is that if you look at this group of loci, then these two are farther away in one dimension than these two, but they can interact more frequently because they're in the same domain. Okay. So what this means is that these domains are kind of little areas of interaction, where you get a lot of interaction inside and not a lot of interactions with things outside.
So I think it's like pearls on a necklace, and sort of like globules, after globule, after globule,
right?
And they're in variable size pearls.
And this covers the whole genome. And in fact, these are not only conserved between cell types, but even if you look between species, in regions that are conserved, you see the same structures. Okay. Furthermore, you even see similar kinds of structures. This is in yeast and even in bacteria. So
that was a specific mountain that you found in human and in the mouse.
Yes.
And it says ESC. What does that mean?
Embryonic stem cells. It's a specific cell type, but it doesn't really matter because they're conserved.
And human chromosome 12 is homologous to mouse chromosome 10?
In this area. Yeah. So it only makes sense if the areas are in general conserved.
Okay. So what is the scale, particularly on the bacterial one? It must be much smaller?
Yes, it's much smaller. It's they're around 50 kb.
Per pixel or whatever?
No, I'm saying, per tab size, I think. I need to check this.
And there are proteins that play the role of histones in the secret synthesis?
In here, they don't. Here, there aren't any histones in bacteria.
Not conventional histones.
Here they are.
But there's some wrapping. I thought there was some organization.
There might be, but it's very, very different, probably. Very, very
you can't really do the standard high C on that loop thing. You don't have
right. There are other things. There are other things that are associated with the genome. So you can actually do HiSeq, but probably the mechanisms underlying these things are different. Okay. So just stop me when you want me to stop.
All right.
What's topological about these domains? Topological
or
conventional mathematical sense.
Sounds
nice.
It's not. I don't think there's a very good reason of why this should be called this.
Should I keep going?
Let's say. So, what did you have in your computer to show us and give me an idea what's in store for us? Maybe we can shorten it. How many more slides were you going to show?
A lot. But I can finish with the TADS and one more type of interaction, and then
let's do that.
Okay. So just I want to talk about the functional aspects of TADS. So it turns out that this is very interesting, not just as a higher order structure, but also also for gene regulation. So there's this central problem of understanding how enhancers know to interact with which promoters they need to interact. So it turns out that this kind of serves as a micro environment that specifies, that only promoters and enhancers in this environment are going to interact with each other. So one nice experiment is that if you take a reporter gene, so this is a gene that can just, when it expresses, it gives some color. So this is an embryo, mouse embryo, and it gives some color where it's expressed, in the tissues where it's expressed. And you put this gene each time in a different place, once here, and once here, and once here, and once here. And what you see is that as you move along the genome, the places where it's expressed change. Okay? And what you see is that this matches very well the TAD domains. Okay? So the idea is that when a gene is over here, it can sense the regulatory environment of the enhancers here. Okay? So as long as the gene is in here, these enhancers control it, and then when it moves here, then it's this one, and so on.
And the probability is proportional to the color?
The probability of
expression or something like this? How can you?
The strength of expression has the... Not only, but in general, an enhancer active in an early stage will cause these kinds of patterns, because these are usually developmental enhancers that cause genes to be activated only in one tissue type.
What am I supposed to get from this? The four are quite similar and different than the other.
So
what am I looking at?
I think it's hard to see here, but these are kind of similar in terms of this one, this. This is believe the experts. I'm not an expert.
What?
This one is different. Then this one is different. Then this one is different.
So the first three have a different.
It's one. It's one. Color. It's one example. I'm not sure this is the most convincing one. This is the general idea. It's still in the level of a hypothesis.
So
I have better examples, but
a way to say it would be, if I color anything within one mountain, it will be regulated like any place else in that mountain.
Right. If you put a gene without any regulatory information, kind of a blank gene, then it will acquire the regulation of whatever is within this domain. That's the general.
All right.
I have better examples, but you won't get to see them. okay. And just the last thing I want to show you, I'll just skip it a little bit. This one is that when you get to high resolution, this was just done this year. If you sequence a lot, you have a lot of money. So you can then kind of break the resolution limit and get to really high resolutions and even see things like this, which are kind of point interactions between two elements, very, very localized. So this is just from this year, and this is probably where we're going to get fancy sequencing. And here also, you can go back to the genome, and you can actually find very nice things like underlying here. There's a specific protein that binds, and only when they bind in the correct orientation, so there's a specific sequence that recognizes. Only when this is in this orientation, and the other was is the in the opposite orientation, you get this. Otherwise, you don't. So you can really get them into biological networks. This is really the power of genomics, why you want to end up with mapping to where all these features are, translating them into long tracks and so on. And then you can go do experiments like flipping it to see what happens and so on. Okay. So I think I'm going to end here. So I'll just end with acknowledgments to my lab mates and to Yob. And thanks.
Now we know all about what these are. Yes. Okay. We had a lot of questions during the talk. Are there further questions? Jim. You look sort of like you're on the verge of asking a question.
I'm going to ask a private question to this guy. I'm not going to display my ignorance.
Carly.
And the last thing that you showed, how did the separation compare to the persistence length of DNA? You were getting very close.
The persistence length is much, much smaller. Of naked DNA? Persistence length of naked DNA is a few hundred base pairs, for all I know. 150 or 300.
Right, so it's one content of one of those little spindles.
Right.
So the persistence like this is way, way bigger than that.
Yeah, this was 1,000. The last plot was about 1,000.
No, the region was not 1,000. The resolution was 1,000. So the region was much longer.
Each pixel was 1,000.
Yes, each pixel was 1,000.
Okay.
So it's still not close to persistence length being interesting, I think.
So in the beginning, you described distant places interacting via the paradigm of a promoter that was activated somehow mm-hmm. by some very distant thing. Mm-hmm. And have you actually seen something that specific with this technique, or those are within your resolution?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So when you see these point interactions, in this last paper, they found something like between 3,000 and 8,000, I think, some such point interactions in a cell. And they say only 30% of them are promoter-enhancer interactions. So I think it's probably not all the interactions.
At least they're seeing known promoter-enhancer
yes,
interactions.
They are. But not all of them are promoter enhancer.
So you could say they could make a correspondence between this adjacency feature that shows up in the maps of those two biots
yes.
and some function
yes.
that is a genetic function of you put something on this place
and
you get something
it.
Out
yeah.
that's
but
expressed.
Again, it's not completely clear yet, because you can see places where a gene is activated without having this. You can see places where you have this, and the gene is not active. So,
and are there promoter enhancer pairs that go between chromosomes, different chromosomes?
That's a controversial issue. I'm not convinced there's good evidence for something like that. And at least if there is something that happens like that. It's very infrequent. So there are suggestions that there are things that happen specifically between genes in different chromosomes. So there are things that happen like that. We know that they're functional. There are specific genes that we know that need to be active together. I'm pretty certain that they don't all happen in the same cell, because they're very, very infrequent in terms of how we see them. So if you want to get function out of that, that's a good question of how you get robust function with something that interacts very infrequently. So it might be a set of genes that, you know, some of them interact in a specific cell and some interacting in a different, but you never see, at least I've never seen something which is very, very strong to the extent that we see inside the chromosome.
And can you, go ahead. I thought there were also repressors.
There are also repressors. It's less well understood, I think. And the classic repressors which are understood better are in bacteria and yeast, where you don't have these long range.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this last point with these off-diagonal interactions and so on is very interesting, because one of the things that's always sort of bothered me about this is the fundamentally indirect nature of it. Again, to harp on this point about interaction being a loaded word. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems this is putting the meat on that term. So is there a sense within the community, when you see an interaction map, what fraction of that information is real causal connection or microscopic connection versus just coincidental proximity? Because in principle, you can't distinguish the two.
So yeah, causality is a big issue that is still controversial in terms of what causes what. I think for some things like the TADs, it seems that, you know, at first people thought it might be that there's something inside the TAD, like genes get expressed and then it causes this. But just the fact that they're very conserved between cell types and so on seems that it's something that is, that can be causal.
So it's reassuring. I mean, all this I admit is sort of getting reassuring with that
yeah.
word. But in principle, when I first started hearing about this, I found it very odd to determine interaction with them.
Right. With compartments, I think the causality is, with the genomic compartments, it's less clear, and that's, I think, one reason why people are not that interested in it. But yeah, it's a big issue, and part of the problem with promoter-enhancer interactions is that there's really no other experiment that's like a gold standard that you can compare to. So it's difficult, but we're getting there.
Is it brief? Make it brief, because we should go.
Yeah, there is a type of cancers which we have chromosomal translocations, such as sarcomas. Have you ever tried to figure out that your method can find any sign of cancer? So you can take a small tissue, and if you see that kind of translocations, you can predict that cell's cancerous.
Yes. So I think if I understand correctly, there are two things. We've definitely thought about these things. There are actually three points that are relevant to this. One thing is that you find that regions that are close to each other in 3D tend to translocate together in cancer. The other point is that with a model, which I did not show you, of how TADs are, I have some model of how TADs are encoded, where I propose essentially that they're encoded locally. So you can predict what happens in translocations. How the interaction changes in translocations.
What is a translocation?
Translocation is when a part of the chromosome moves somewhere else. It can flip or something. The chromosome gets rearranged, essentially.
And that's cancerous?
Yes.
So you are
in cancers, like the genomes get shuffled. That.
So you can't see linear sequencing?
It's difficult. This has to do actually with this was my last point. Has to do with the other project which I was working on, which is trying to infer the one-dimensional arrangement of the genome, or to build the genome de novo from this data. And actually, it turns out to be very, very useful. And it's difficult to do with the new technologies, because the reads that you get from the technologies are very, very short. So yeah, it turned out to be very useful. Yeah.
Coffee.
Thank you.